Hey, this is Melvin. We're actually on break from the Selling the Couch podcast, but I thought it would be fun just to share some of the most popular episodes as well as some of my most favorite episodes from Selling the Couch. We've had over 200 episodes now, and I know that for me, listening to some of these old episodes, I always pick up something and learn something new. So I hope that you enjoy today's session. Before we do get to today's session, I just wanted you to encourage you to check out the Selling the Couch directory if you haven't had a chance. Basically, the directory makes it easier for us to connect and support one another as we grow our businesses. So after you register and you sign up, you create a profile that lets us know more about your practice, the good work that you're doing in the world, the unique niches that you serve, niches beyond just a traditional DSM diagnosis, groups and workshops and retreats and areas of consultation, all of those different things. And after you fill that out, it's actually way easier than it sounds. But after you fill it out, your practice gets placed on a Google map. That way, fellow couchies can find you in order to cross-refer clients. If they need a consult on a certain area, they can do that as well. One of the things that we actually have been working on that I'm just like really excited about with this recent update is we created a custom cross-refer tool. So if you look on any of these online communities, a lot of times you'll see, you know, hey, I'm looking for, you know, a clinician that lives in this area, that accepts this insurance, that, you know, works with millennials. And so we thought, why not just make it easy and create a tool to do this? So you basically can run just some filters so you can, you know, ask questions like that. And you click just a number of different things and you get search results, and it makes the process of just cross-referring a lot easier. You can learn more about the directory over at sellingthecouch.com/directory. And please enter the promo code podcast for your first month absolutely free. We'll get right to today's session. Here we go. Hello, hello. Welcome to session 169 and a brand new season of the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join me for today's podcast session. So this past month, I actually took a little bit of a break. I've been trying to take about 3 months of the year just to take a break from the podcast. One, just to be able to rest and focus on self-care, practice what I preach, but also just to, you know, have some episodes in the bank so that I don't ever miss any weeks of episodes or anything like that. And most importantly, I am making the transition, hopefully here in the next couple of weeks, to being a dad for the first time. And so I know that fatherhood and having a newborn is going to change my life quite a bit. At least that's what I've been told. I'm hoping I don't lose sleep too much, but I just wanted to make sure I had some episodes in the bank for you guys. Today's podcast session is a topic that I can't tell you the amount of emails and messages I've received from colleagues talking about this topic, which is building a practice through the loss of a loved one. My guest today is Nikki Sewell. Nikki is a licensed clinical social worker, and in today's session, we're actually just going to have an honest conversation. Just to give you a little bit of a background, Nikki and her husband, who is a psychiatrist, had dreams of starting a private practice together, and about 6 months in, her husband, Andrew, went in for surgery, had complications, and passed away. Nikki was 30 years old when Andrew passed away. In today's conversation, we're going to have just a conversation about building a practice through grief and loss and some of the practical things to do and all of those different things. So more specifically, we're going to cover a range of different things. One is, what inspired Nikki to get into practice with her significant other? And after her husband had passed away, how did she feel the strength, have the strength and the resolve to build the practice? And then how did she sort of change the vision for her practice? And then Nikki actually decided to niche down into focusing on grief and loss in her private practice. And we're going to really explore this topic of building a niche and focusing on a niche when that niche is so personal to us. Before we get to today's podcast session, I just wanted to take a moment to thank the team over at Hushmail for supporting this week's and this month's podcast. If you guys haven't heard of Hushmail, Hushmail is a company that allows us to send HIPAA-compliant encrypted emails to clients. So if you're using some of Gmail, for example, Gmail does not, even G Suite does not actually come encrypted. Now, G Suite does sign like BAA, but it doesn't have the encryption feature, which is where Hushmail really stands out. And so you can send encrypted emails to clients and communicate with clients and, you know, share personal health information and know that you're doing it in a way that's both encrypted and HIPAA secure. You can learn more about Hushmail and the awesome services that they provide over at sellingthecouch.com/Hushmail. And if you actually look on that page, there is a 20% discount code that is just for STC listeners. So we will get right to today's podcast conversation. Here's my conversation with Nikki Sewell. Hi, Nikki. Welcome to Selling the Couch.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to our conversation. We were talking about this right before we started, but I feel like practices and business building, that just because we're doing that doesn't mean that life, you know, stops and life and events and all of those things don't happen.
Certainly.
So your husband was a psychiatrist.
Uh-huh,
and he was. You're a social worker.
Yes.
What inspired you guys to start a practice together?
So about 6 years ago, we had started thinking about having a family. We were both working full-time. He was working more than full-time because he was picking up moonlighting shifts at different local hospitals. And we had thought about, you know, in the context of having children, how would that work with two people working, in some cases, more than full-time? And so we thought that private practice would give me flexibility where I would do that 3 days a week. And then he would be my bed backup. And that would be a bit more lucrative and a bit more flexible for him. So he wouldn't have to be picking up as many moonlighting shifts in the community. Mm-hmm. And so that was the initial inspiration for the practice.
I guess the big thing I take from that is really wanting to build a career and a business around family.
Yes. And having that flexibility over your hours, so you're not locked into, oh, got to be at work at 8:30. Oh, can't leave until 5 o'clock, right? Yeah. Or sometimes later, depending on what popped up.
I've heard like nightmare stories of moonlighting, you know?
Yes.
What kind of hours was he working at that time?
So it would be like he'd have his usual 9 to 5, and then he would moonlight from 5 until 8 the next morning. Yeah. So it'd be an overnight shift. And he would do that, you know, depending on the month, depending on the week, sometimes once a week, sometimes once a month, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, just depended on where we were at and what we were saving for.
Absolutely. Was it hard to even like make that shift of, okay, this is something that we're doing now and something that we've gotten into a pace and used to doing to, okay, maybe we just needed like shift to private practice?
For him, maybe more so than for me, because he was such a busybody and was always on the go and was just nonstop. If the man didn't have to sleep, he wouldn't. If it wasn't a requirement, he wouldn't, you know? And private practice is certainly a much slower pace than what he was used to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like many of us are wired this way, which is like we're just hard workers. And the thought of like not cramming our schedules full of stuff, there's like, I don't know if it's like we have these, at least for me, I feel like a narrative I always struggle with is like I'm being unproductive or I'm being lazy.
Yes. Yes. Or if you're having a lazy Sunday, like that's somehow a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, nothing like starting your own business in a way actually to help you set those boundaries over time.
Absolutely.
When you guys first started the practice, what was that initial vision for the practice?
So we didn't really know what we were doing. I mean, I have learned so much over the past 6 years and kind of off and on being in private practice, which we'll get to. But the general idea was that I would just kind of take anybody and everybody that walked through the door, right? And that in the case of them needing medications, then he would be their prescriber. Mm-hmm. And again, I think I'd already said that, you know, the idea was that I'd be doing it 3 days a week and probably making the same income that I would be making working 5 days a week in the hospital, right, where I was working before.
I actually wanted to ask you about that 3 days a week. How did you guys settle on like 3 days a week versus 4 or 5 or 2?
You know, honestly, I can't remember. I think that's a great question, but I don't remember. I think three was just kind of it seemed like a good number, I guess. The idea of 24 hours a week, whether that meant 24 patients, but, or more just 24 hours of kind of dedicated to, you know, all the ins and outs that go toward private practice, whether it's, you know, the billing and the note taking and all that stuff.
Mm. So Nikki, like, you guys had this vision for the private practice. How long did it even take to set up the practice and do some of that legwork before?
Right. Okay. So I would say about 2 months between getting on the insurance panels, getting the credentialing process going, hiring a realtor, finding the right space for us to rent, and then finding a subletter to rent the extra office. It was a two office suite that we were renting. So about 2 months to kind of get up and running.
Must have been a jam-packed 2 months.
Yeah. And the 2 months was kind of prior to the 6 or 7 months before he had passed away. So we had a good 6 or 7 months in the private practice before he passed.
Okay. So you guys were already in the private practice when he passed away.
Exactly. Yes. And he had some patients of his own and I had some shared patients and unfortunately had to refer everyone out. And our patients didn't know that we were married. I was still using my maiden name in the practice at the time. And so after he died, having to call people and be like, I'm so sorry, the doctor passed away, I have to refer you. And some of the unknowingly insensitive remarks like, oh, I can't believe this. The first time I found a really great psychiatrist and then he dies. And it's like, Gosh. Yeah, it really sucks. But, you know, I kind of had to do my best to keep my cool in situations like that.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, even,
I don't know how I did it.
I don't know how you did it either. Like you just saying that, I don't know. I found myself like, I don't know, like getting like overwhelmed, you know,
because
you're trying to like contain your own sadness and grief. And then you're trying to be a business owner. And
yes.
And then there is this other piece of, at least it sounds like some clients may not have realized you guys were married. So
right.
How did you said like in that moment you had no idea, but like looking back, like how did you even manage that to hold that grief and then still, you know, let patients know?
I think that, you know, those first couple weeks after you're in this kind of, and I think this applies to any loss that we might experience in life, right? There's this complete surreality or this complete fog that you're in. And it's just, you're taking one step in front of the other and nothing quite feels real. And is this my new reality? And so I think it was almost like, it felt like autopilot, right?
Yeah, right. Like it's almost like you're just doing, but always not fully aware of like what's happening kind of feeling.
Yes. It's kind of a disconnect, I guess.
Right. And we don't have to go into any details. Was this like, but did he pass away from like something health related or how?
Yeah. So it was health related. It was quite unexpected, quite sudden. You know, admittedly, it had a pretty extensive surgery, which he was recovering from. And the morning that he passed away, his treatment team, he passed away in the evening, but his treatment team was talking about discharging him home the next day. And then that evening he died of, you know, I won't go into all the gory details, but died of some post-surgical complications that kind of happened very abruptly and very suddenly.
I guess he was waiting to get discharged, but he was still in the hospital when he passed.
He was, yes, exactly. He was still in the hospital. Yeah.
I don't know what it was like for you because I can't even like, even have a hard time like putting myself in your shoes, you know, but you guys had the vision for this practice, which was you would take care of more of the counseling and he would do medication, right? And that was sort of the dream, build this, have a two office suite, sublet one, you guys would share.
It was perfect. What we had was perfect. We had a perfect balance in between, you know, each of our talents, right? But then we had this great balance of finding this wonderful subletter and everything was going just as it was supposed to.
So after he passed, how did the vision for the practice change?
So I had a few patients that I continued with, I don't know how, and then they kind of graduated within a couple months. And after that, I took almost a year and a half off, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to go back to private practice or if I wanted to do something else entirely. I continued to work at the psychiatric hospital I was working at, which was helpful in kind of providing that regular structured routine that I needed. So he passed in July of 2013, and I think it was November of 2014 that something clicked, and I was just like, you know what? So I guess it wasn't quite a year and a half. I was like, you know what? I'm ready to do this again. And I had been subletting my office after I left, after he passed, to someone else. So I had two subletters in that space, kind of making ends meet, which was very helpful. And we ended up moving into a larger suite in the same building because there wasn't room for all three of us because the person that was subletting my office had kind of grown to the point of full time and was like, we can't really split the office. So either I leave or we move into this bigger suite. And so we did that, which I think was a really good decision because it wasn't kind of walking into that same space that he and I, and walking into that dream that he and I had started together, and then being reminded every day that, oh yeah, like this was the dream that we had and it is no longer, right?
It's amazing in many ways how things do work out.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
I mean, the fact you had a second subletter, the fact that they got
cool,
I mean.
Yes. It all worked out.
On this business journey, and as I just have conversations with other colleagues, like there is this element of, like, I don't think it's luck, but it's just more like fate, maybe, mm-hmm. right? That's some element we can't control in this whole business journey, but somehow it seems to kind of circle and work out. And
you know, maybe
it's not the straight line path we expected, but
yes.
To build a niche in grief and loss, particularly after the loss of a loved one, I imagine can be extremely difficult.
Yeah.
What inspired you to actually build a private practice based on that niche?
So unfortunately, you know, Andrew's death wasn't my first experience with death. My dad had passed away in 2006, and I remember that loss feeling very isolating. Mm. And then when Andrew passed away, again, it was just this sense of loneliness and isolation, in the sense that there was nobody that I could talk to, or that, not that I didn't have people in my life that I could talk to, but nobody got it. Nobody understood. Nobody, you know, was able to kind of share that perspective. And I think that was part of what drove that. It was kind of creating a safe space where grievers at any stage, whether it was a week after their loss or a year after their loss, or in some cases, 10 years after their loss, that they could come in and freely talk about their feelings and their thoughts and the fact that, you know, whether their grief was delayed or whether they felt like they were going crazy or needing to be, you know, validated or normalized, that their feelings needed to be normalized in some way. Hmm. And I think that's kind of what inspired it, was that people need a place where they can talk about this. And unfortunately, sometimes when patients would come to my office, they would say that they'd had a previous therapist who was clearly uncomfortable talking about it and would kind of abruptly change the subject to talk about something else. And I see, even in my community, in our community, I should say, of counselors and therapists, that there are some that are uncomfortable talking about death and dying, right? Which, I mean, it boggles my mind, because we all have to deal with it at some point, whether somebody dies young or old, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you guys that are listening, Nikki's website is over at milfordgrieftherapist.com, and it might be helpful to pull that website up just as we talk. So you didn't just say, I'm going to just focus on grief, right? You actually even niched a little further.
Yeah.
So as we're recording this, like the three big niches that you focus on are the death of a parent, survivors of suicide, and young widows.
Yes. Or young widows and widowers. I just didn't put both.
Widowers.
Yep.
Okay. So young widows and widowers. You focus on sort of those like three, like, I guess, micro niches within that niche.
Sure.
What was it about? Like, it sounds like each was inspired by the death of a parent, I could see with dad.
Right.
Young widows. We talked about this like right before we started recording. If you don't mind me asking, like approximately like how old were you when Andrew passed away?
So I was 30.
I didn't realize you were that young.
Yes. I remember saying the night the doctor came in and said, you know, I'm sorry, he passed. I was like, are you telling, like eventually I got to this place where it's like, are you telling me I'm 30 and I'm a widow? Wow. I laugh now, but like, it was so mind-boggling. Like 30-year-olds aren't widows, or widowers for that matter, right?
Yeah, it doesn't happen like in that sort of natural flow.
Yes, exactly.
I guess it makes sense. Like those two niches, they make sense because they're like personal. And then what made you focus on the survivors of suicide?
So that's also personal. So in 2006, my dad died by suicide. Mm. And so that was a very personal. And again, these aren't things I necessarily share with my patients, but they're topics certainly that resonate on a very personal level. And again, the loss of my dad in the way that I lost my dad was very isolating. And there was so much guilt and shame connected to that loss, and that sense of what did I do wrong, or what more should I have done, or why wasn't I there, or, you know, why didn't he reach out, or all those things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I feel like maybe this is like a constant sort of journey or day-to-day thing, but I feel like when we have niches that are so personal to us, it can be like really hard to compartmentalize or both, I guess, hold our own stories and grief and all of those things while being present with clients. How do you manage to do that, like on a day-to-day? Is it simply sort of like making sure you don't overstress yourself with too many clients, or do you take breaks? Like, how do you handle that?
I think it's a combination of, you know, certainly when I returned to private practice back in at the end of 2014, I didn't immediately start seeing patients on the grief and loss spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. That I've been doing that for about 2 years now. So I think part of it was knowing that I was healed enough from my own losses to be able to do the work that I do. But the other piece is that because I work part-time in the emergency room, my private practice is part-time. So a typical day, I'll see four or five patients. And it sounds maybe strange or ironic or, you know, insert some other appropriate word here, but I actually find the work that I do so uplifting, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just such an honor that people come to my office and we have these conversations about how to process their loss and how to maintain a connection with their lost loved one, whether it's, you know, whether it's their mother, whether it's their father, whether it's a sibling, whether it's a spouse. And it's just, it's a real honor to do that work.
I mean, I think it's actually the perfect word because you said it earlier that even when you were going through this process, you didn't necessarily have a place, right?
Yes,
and the fact that you created this place and then that folks are willing to share.
Right? Yeah, in part, it's kind of repairing isn't that what we all do in some ways, right? I mean, therapists or otherwise, right? We kind of repair our pasts, mm-hmm. right? And so maybe that's part of this process as well, providing a space that I didn't feel like I necessarily had.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to actually just take a step back. So with each of these niches, the death of a parent, survivors of suicide, and young widows / widowers, mm-hmm. you have quotes when you click on each of those.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right? I mean, they're like perfect quotes for those niches. How
Thank
did you find them? Like, how did you decide that those would be the quotes?
Oh gosh. So the Maya Angelou one on the parent page, that one I had come across shortly after my dad passed away. And we had our ups and downs in our relationship. But there was so much truth to that last line where she talks about no matter, I forget exactly what it is because I don't have my website right in front of me, but no matter what your relationship is with your parent, you will miss them. I have learned that you will miss them when they're gone from your life. And that's so true, however close or not close we might have been. And then remind me of the other two quotes. I think that the one about the widow,
The widow one is the Genevieve Davis.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, that book like dedicated like 8 pages to young widows specifically. And the rest was kind of a broad kind of look at a widow's grief and widow's loss. But I think that resonated because being a young widow or losing a husband or wife young is, it's such a unique experience, right? And it's obviously much more rare than someone who loses their husband when they're in their 70s or their wife, I should say husband or wife, when they're in their 70s, their 80s or whatnot. The tragedy in your loss, a colleague actually shared very early on in my loss, she said the tragedy in your loss is the loss of that anticipated future, whereas the tragedy in the loss of someone who's died in their 70s or their 80s, right, who's lost their spouse in their 70s or their 80s. The tragedy in that loss is that they've lost their life partner, someone that they have spent their whole entire life with, right? And that's kind of the difference between the two, right?
Yeah, I never thought of it like in that sort of way. That's such a good way to distinguish it.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to ask you, like, even dive a little deeper.
Sure.
I'm just going to read like a little section of this page for young widows. You write so well. And
oh, thank you.
I don't know. It's like you're in the mind of somebody that would go through. I'm going to stop talking. I'm just going to read. Okay.
Sure.
I'll just read like the first couple of sentences. Like many other young widows, your husband was your best friend, your partner, your lover, your universe. Not only have you lost him, you've lost your identity. You ask yourself, my husband died. Now who am I? No matter how many supports you have, you're lonely. You feel hollow. A void that can only be filled. In a room full of people, you still feel alone. No one gets you. No one understands you or your pain. You've never met anyone who's been there. And you write like even more extensively in this page, but I don't know, how did you find these words?
Because that's how I felt. I think we're both part of this community, right? The business school bootcamp, right?
Right.
And Kelly and Miranda talk about, you know, the authentic, the ATP, I forget now what it stands for, but really connecting with who you're writing to, right? And so I think maybe partly I was connecting with myself and writing that, right? And I know I've met both my personal journey and my professional journey in this area. I've met many other young widows and who have kind of shared that same sentiment about just feeling so alone and feeling like nobody gets it and not knowing which way to turn, where to find somebody that you can talk to that's going to understand what you're going through, right? people who've been divorced, it's, you know, it's a different kind of loss, right? I'm not trying to minimize the pain, right? It's just different, right? So you might have a girlfriend that you confide in about, you know, being a widow, and it's just, they don't get it. It's just a different loss.
Right.
And just, I think, like, you don't get their loss, right? Because a divorce is different than being widowed.
Right. And I think part of what we have to do on our websites is, one, I think, distinguish the subtleties in those losses, and then speak to one person in one situation.
Yes. Yes.
In one situation versus.
And I think that's, you know, also when I think of every widow or widower that I've worked with, right? Just because they have this loss, right? This kind of shared loss, so to speak, it doesn't mean that there's anything universal about that experience, right? But like you say, it's such an individual experience, whether it's the way the spouse died or the relationship, what the relationship looked like before the spouse died, whether there were children involved or not.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I didn't get a chance to, like, fully explore some of the posts and stuff, but do you ever, like, write content based on those kind of, like, subtleties like that? Like,
no. So that's a plan. I need to get into blogging. Kelly and Miranda have told me that, and multiple colleagues have been like, you need to start blogging more. And I just, I have a blogging block that I need to work through, but I think those are great topics to write about.
Yeah. Well, for what it's worth, you write extremely well.
Thank you.
You know, actually, the Mac actually has built-in transcription. So you could actually just speak. And
now that I've got my fancy headphones.
Yeah. And actually, you don't even need them.
Okay.
They're all, I'll show you. It actually has a dictation built right in.
Nice.
Yeah. I wanted to shift and wrap up with two kind of questions, which are, the first one is, what are the top three ways that you market this niche?
So I would say that funeral homes are a good referral source. Hospice has been also a good referral source. So when people kind of graduate out or phase out because they only have a certain length of time that they can continue to receive services at the hospice where their spouse died, that's one place. And also some assisted living communities have reached out. Maybe one spouse lives in their own independent apartment, but the other spouse is on, you know, the dementia unit or in the skilled nursing facility with some sort of chronic debilitating life-threatening illness. And the spouse is coming to kind of find ways to, you know, cope. And are there ways that we can kind of anticipatorily grieve, right, the loss of a partner?
Well, when you reach out to these, like when you go to the funeral home or the, you know, or the assisted living facility, I mean, do you just go in with business cards or do you say, like, do you do a presentation? Like, how do you?
So I have sent letters, similar to other therapists who have sent letters to, like, primary care offices. And I've offered to do, nobody's taken me up on it, unfortunately, like lunch and learns, right? To come in and talk and bring in some food and have a conversation about what I do and what I might have to offer. And in one case, one of the assisted livings had actually reached out to me through a colleague because they connected with another colleague who primarily specializes in kids and teens. And they had asked her if she was interested in doing some sort of, you know, grief support group for people who were struggling with losing a family member, whether it was a, you know, parent, spouse, adult, child, etc. And she said, you know what, I'm not the right person for you to talk to, but let me send you Nikki's way. And so that's how one of those referral sources came to be.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, I think one of the things I love about how you're marketing is you didn't just say, you know what, I work with grief and loss and I'm just going to throw these letters out into the
right,
window.
Right, right.
Throw them out.
It's offering something in return.
Yeah. Right. And you focused on, you thought about who are the people that are already in front of my ideal clients.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Instead of like randomly going to, you know, like, I don't know, a pediatrician is probably not...
Right, right, right. Or even a primary care office. Right. I mean, I guess people might come in, you know, asking for support or direction, but it wouldn't be as common.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As we wrap up, what would you say is the number one advice that you would give to someone who wants to create a private practice that's focused on grief and loss?
I think it would be that, you know, knowing that grief and loss is not, or grief period, is not a neat and tidy process. And so if you're approaching or conceptualizing grief as this neat and tidy five stages that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, that, you know, I would encourage someone to kind of go out and explore other frameworks. So anything related to meaning making, the four tasks of mourning, the dual process model of grief. There's lots of other frameworks out there that are so much better at explaining and predicting even the grief process. Certainly, you know, we don't go through these kind of, like I said, neat and tidy stages of, you know, first the denial and the bargaining and then the depression and the anger. And it's not to say that we don't experience those things, but again, it's not in a a neat and tidy sequential process. That's just not grief. And that's not the human experience, period, right?
Yeah, it's not like you come to resolution and then it just goes away.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I was just having this conversation with a girlfriend recently about how losses continue to haunt, right? Years can go by, right? And even sometimes I have moments missing my dad, like on Father's Day, right? Or a random day that he pops into my head and it never goes away, right? I function, certainly, and I'm not in that acute stage of grief, certainly. But, you know, the loss will always be with me, just like it will be with anyone else who's ever lost anyone in their life.
Right. Nikki, this is really my last question.
Sure.
It's just such an interesting niche, and I'm very curious. So you mentioned a number of like trainings, and if you could think of like one particular training or even seminar or model that's been really helpful for you, what would you say that one is?
I would say that if someone could go to a conference for the weekend, there's this organization called ADEC, the Association of Death Education and Counseling. And I've been a few times and I've actually presented on the topic of young widowhood there. And it's an amazing organization and they have so many resources and they draw participants from so many different aspects of whether it's psychotherapy or psychiatry or even a funeral home, for example, that was offering a support group. I've met some really great people and learned so much from the organization. So that would be the one thing off the top of my head that I might recommend. And that's partly where I learned about a lot of these different frameworks for understanding grief.
Yeah, no, that definitely will put that in the show notes, which you can find over at sellingthecouch.com/session-168. Nikki, thank you so much for doing this. I know this was a hard topic to talk about, but I know that a lot of our colleagues are going through seasons like this, and yes. I'm just so grateful for you.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Hey there. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Nikki, and particularly if you're in a season of loss, I hope that today's podcast session has been just encouraging for you. I think when I was thinking about recording this session, I was thinking about the questions, and I just kept thinking, man, I know that there's a lot of our colleagues in the field that are really struggling through loss. And I just wanted to, more than anything, create this session to be able to support them. Nikki mentioned a number of resources and tips, and you can find all of that over at sellingthecouch.com/session-169. We actually added the dash more recently so you can again find all of the information. And Nikki's website is again over at milfordgrieftherapist.com. As I was reflecting on this conversation with Nikki, I just wanted to actually highlight one thing one more time, which is Nikki didn't just focus on creating a practice with grief and loss, but she actually niched down one more. And this is a pattern that I have noticed in my own business journey and then also with lots of conversations with a lot of our colleagues on these podcast episodes, is that the ones that do particularly well with niching, they don't niche to one level, they actually niche to a second level and even sometimes even beyond, so that they're not trying to serve everyone, but they're actually serving one unique type of client. And even when they write content on their website, they're speaking to that one specific type of client. So for example, Nikki is not trying to speak to everyone that has grief and loss, but she's, for example, just speaking to the young widow or the young widower. As we wrap up, I just wanted to thank the team over at Hushmail for supporting today's podcast session. If you guys are looking for a HIPAA-compliant encryption solution for your email, I encourage you to check out Hushmail. One of the really cool features of Hushmail is that we can actually send and receive emails and documents from our clients, even if the clients don't have a Hushmail account, so it's not required that our clients have to have a Hushmail account. You can learn more about Hushmail and all of the different stuff that they provide, including live support and a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 20% off coupon just for SDC listeners over at sellingthecouch.com/Hushmail. Have a great rest of your day, and thanks again. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Selling the Couch podcast. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit www.sellingthecouch.com.
Hey there, hope you enjoyed today's podcast session, and especially if this is your second time listening to this podcast session, I hope that you've picked up just a new level of insight and something that helps you on your private practice journey. As I mentioned at the beginning, we'll be back with new episodes very soon. And before we wrap up again, just wanted to encourage you to check out the Selling the Couch directory over at sellingthecouch.com/directory. I actually wanted to use this time just to talk a little bit more about not just the directory, but what we're doing and what my big vision for STC is. You know, as Selling the Couch grows, what really weighs on me is how do we use our influence and how do we use the resources? And for me, how do I steward well all of what I'm creating? And so we're actually taking 50% of the profits from directory sales to create a scholarship fund for kids who have been rescued from brothels in the commercial sex trade. When I was a grad student, I was very fortunate to work 3 weeks in Bombay, India with the NGO and with social workers in Kamathipura, which is the largest concentrated red light district in the world. It's the largest red light district in Asia. And I spent 3 weeks there, spent a day right in the heart of the of the red light district, going into brothels with the social workers, doing lots of education on everything from HIV/AIDS, all the way to trying to figure out what some of these workers, the challenges they were facing. And I spent the majority of my time about 5 hours away, helping at a school where the kids of these workers were, and just to teaching different classes, getting to spend time with them, reading bedtime stories to the little ones. And ever since all of that happened, I just have always felt like, man, if I ever get the chance to do some big things in the world, I want to make sure that everything I create leads to something way bigger than me. And so, and fortunately, Selling the Couch happened, and now the STC directory is happening. And so this is where I'm hoping that, you know, we can dedicate our time and our resources, and I really have some big plans as we go forward with this. Again, you can learn more about the Selling the Couch directory over at sellingthecouch.com/directory. Be sure to enter the promo code podcast to get your first month absolutely free. Have a great rest of your day, and I will see you next time.